Today we're in the second period. We're doing the second 500 years this week and next week. And so we're going to begin in Ireland, and we'll talk about that briefly. And then talk about monasticism. I'll do some introductory comments. I'll go to that. So year 500 is where we're at. Give you a couple of pieces of humor. There's history from college student papers. Let's read this together. Pharaoh forced the Hebrew slaves to make bread without straw, which probably tastes a lot better. Moses led them to the Red Sea, where they made unleavened bread, which is bread made without any ingredients. That's a miracle. Afterwards, Moses went up to Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments. David was a Hebrew king skilled at playing the lyre. There's some poetry in that. He fought with the philatelists. The philatelist, as you know, is a stamp collector. I think that was probably the Philistines. A race of people lived in biblical times. Solomon was one of David's sons, 500 wives and 500 porcupines. Very different companions to have a concubine or a porcupine. During the Renaissance, America began. Christopher Columbus, great navigator who discovered America while cursing the Atlantic, which is probably true about 6 weeks out when he couldn't find land. His ships were called the Nina, the Pinta, and the Santa Fe. Later, the pilgrims crossed the ocean. This is called Pilgrim's Progress. Poor John Bunyan lost his book. They landed at Plymouth Rock, greeted by Indians, came down the hill rolling their hoops before them. The Indian squabs carried porpoises on their back. Many of the Indian heroes were killed along with their cabooses, which proved very fatal to them, no doubt. The winter of 1620 was a hard one for settlers. Many people died. Many babies were born. John Smith was responsible for all this. John Smith, of course, was part of the Virginia settlement and never went to New England. So there you have a little break. College students didn't quite get it right. During the Middle Ages, you've all seen the rooster as a weather vane. This began to be seen all over Europe on the rooftops. Why? Pope Gregory I, called Gregory the Great, the first monk to become a pope. John Calvin said, Gregory I was the last good pope in history. So this was a pretty good guy. Sent a lot of missionaries to the northern part of Europe. Said that the rooster was the most suitable emblem of Christianity, being the emblem of St. Peter. Ninth century Pope Nicholas ordered the figure to be placed on every church steeple as a warning against denying Christ. So there you have, that's why we see roosters as weather vanes even today. Come back to this in a second. Want to make this point, it is not wise or intellectually healthy to ignore the work of the Holy Spirit in the minds of believers over the last 2,000 years. If you're only familiar with the first century and the Reformation Church, what has God revealed through his people that you have missed? Obviously, the church is a lot more than the last 500 years and the first century. And so we want to think about that, especially as we go into a period of time that most of you may not have studied for a while, the early Middle Ages. Christianity, in contrast to Islam comes in the early part of this section. Muhammad died in 632. Has a huge impact on the Middle East and Asia Minor and North Africa and Spain. And impacts us today, of course. Islam did not see truth as something that had to be built on, but they saw it as settled truth. So they see the Quran as something that we don't expand or build on, but as settled truth. Same way they read Aristotle. Christianity, on the other hand, built on the foundation in the New Testament, if you think of last 2 weeks ago. We saw it, the Apostles' Creed got expanded into the Nicene Creed, which got expanded into the Athanasian Creed, which turns into the Westminster Confession that Kim agreed to follow this morning in the service. The Apostles' Creed can be said in about 60 seconds. The Westminster Confession probably takes a couple of hours to read through. That's the expansion of truth as we continue to think through and reason through what God has revealed to us. Western civilization built on that century after century, producing the massive progress of human thinking in the West, thanks to Paul turning west instead of east, and huge leap forwards in theories of government, science, medicine, equality of women, minorities. Women had a much better position in the Middle Ages than they did in the Roman Empire, and much, much better than in the Greek Empire. Economics, law, and justice. Agriculture, views of war, and systematic theology. I invited Russell Crowe today to make this point. This is from the movie Gladiator. It's actually one of the better movies that tries to get history right. But what is very common is directors are very careful about getting the costuming right and getting the swords looking just right. And then they put into the mouths of their actors thoughts and words that would never be said by that generation. You have to get the worldview right when you have these people say these things. Three of the worst films historically are Ben-Hur, the old one with Charlton Heston, Spartacus, Kirk Douglas, and the worst one of all, Cleopatra with Elizabeth Taylor, yes, thank you. So beware, those are not very good history. Now we go back to this. We saw St. Patrick brought Christianity to Ireland in the middle of the 400s. And Thomas Cahill, maybe you've read the book, How the Irish Saved Civilization. This is a good book to read for the first chapter and the last chapter. The middle of it's a lot of detail, but the first and the last chapter are excellent, especially the first chapter, because it starts with this and shows you the transition from the classical world to the period that we're going to enter now. So let me read for you just the opening of that book. On the last cold day in December, in the dying year we count as 406, the Rhine River froze solid, providing the natural bridge that hundreds of thousands of hungry men, women, and children had been waiting for. Let me say something about the word hungry. Of all the things that have caused humans to die in the last few thousand years, number one is not warfare. It is not disease. It's starvation. And so finding food sources is a really big deal. And so when the barbarian, the word is Greek, and barbarian means anybody that's not Greek. The Greek said, we cannot really understand the babbling of all these foreigners. And so they said, it sounds like ba, 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 ba to us. And so the word barbarian is just that word, babblers. To the Romans, an undistinguished, matted mass of others, not terrifying, just troublemakers, annoyances, things one would rather not have to deal with, non-Romans. To themselves, they were presumably something more, but as the literate, illiterate, leave few records, we can only surmise their opinion of themselves. And so this presents the barbarians on the north bank and the Romans on the south bank. And Alaric and his Visigoths, Visigoth is Western Goths, Ostrogoths are Eastern Goths, They moved down through Italy to Rome, surrounded the city. The Roman representatives came out to negotiate. The envoys quickly recognized their man was no fool. All right, then, what was the price of his departure? What does it take to have you leave Rome alone? Alaric said, I'll have my men sweep through the city, take all the gold and silver and everything of value. They'll round up and cart off all of the barbarian slaves, which would be their cousins. And so we'll leave with that. And said, but protested the hysterical envoys, what would that leave us? Alaric said, your lives. At that moment, Roman security died and a new world was conceived. The Roman Empire picked up their marbles and moved east. And so the Roman Empire continued for another 1,000 years in the east, based in Constantinople, the new Rome. Old Rome was, over the next 2 centuries, abandoned and given over to the barbarians, the German tribes. And so you see, Western Europe is really the Wild West. And for the next 500 years, Christians, as the only organizing force of Western civilization, was passing with the death of Roman Empire in the West, Rome being abandoned, and Christendom, that is, Christianity, was born as the only remaining cultural force. They had the literacy, they had the scholarship, they had the organization, they had the morality to convert Europe and turn Western civilization into the progressive thing that it had become. So as we approach the Middle Ages, we ask this question. What was the high point of Christianity in the last 2,000 years? Obviously, in 30 AD, we're starting with 11 guys that turns into a Pentecost, 120 people, which by that afternoon became 3,000 people, moves out from Jerusalem to Antioch and around the empire, and grows. Today, we have a diminishing influence in Western civilization, in our culture. And so is this a good illustration? Did the massive influence, I overuse the word massive, so I need to get some synonyms for that, so I'll try to avoid that in some future lectures. Massive influence that the church had in the medieval period, does this reflect the best version of the kingdom of God? Did the fact that the deity of Christ was recognized in every major city in Europe represent this expansion of the mustard seed into the tree? It was a capital crime in every city in Europe in the Middle Ages to deny the deity of Christ. Not true today. Does the weakness of the church in our culture reflect the decline of civilization? Does the emphasis on the here and now diminish our view of the afterlife? We'll talk about that. So there's one possibility. How about this one? Or is this a better representation of the history of Christianity with ups and downs, but gradual progress? Does the fact that the creeds build upon, as we just said, previous versions reflect improved thinking, greater consistency in interpreting God's revealed word? Or take the view of women. Does anyone think we should return to a Middle Ages view of women or take away their right to vote? I would think most of us would not get supper tonight if we advocated that. So there's an advance. In a way, both of these are true. There's something really valuable to see in what happens in Europe when Christianity dominates the culture and we look at what that influence created in our civilization. And we'll try to... I hope we get to the place where we can talk about Beowulf that we all had to read in high school, right? If we get to that slide, we will have accomplished what we need to today. We'll see if we can get there. This is from David Bentley Hart's Atheist Delusions, The Christian Revolution and Its Fashionable Enemies. He presents this as the way this period of history that we're talking about, the early Middle Ages, is presented in colleges today. Hence, modernity's first great attempt to define itself, be patient as I read this to you, I think it's a good statement, an age of reason emerging from and overthrowing the age of faith. Behind this definition lay a simple but thoroughly enchanting tale. Once upon a time it went, Western humanity was the cosseted, that means babied, and incurious, means non-questioning, ward of Mother Church, the age of faith. We just accepted whatever the church told us. During this, the age of faith, culture stagnated, science languished, wars of religion were routinely waged, witches were burned by inquisitors, and Western civilization labored in brutish subjugation to dogma, superstition, and the unholy alliance of church and state, withering blast of fanaticism and fideism. Fide is the Latin word for faith. Withering blast of fanaticism and a belief system had long scorched away the last remnants of classical learning. Inquiry was stifled. The literary remains of classical antiquity had long ago been consigned to the fires of faith, and even the great achievements of Greek science were forgotten until the golden age of the Islamic civilization restored them to the West. All was darkness. That is a summary of what they would describe as the Dark Ages, the age of faith, the early Middle Ages. Then, in the wake of the wars of religion that had torn Christendom apart, came the full flowering of the Enlightenment, and with it the reign of reason and progress, the riches of scientific achievement, political liberty, and a new revolutionary sense of human dignity. The secular non-nation state arose, reduced religion to an establishment in the state, or in the course of time, to something altogether separate from state, separation of church and state, and therefore rescued Western humanity from the blood-steeped intolerance of religion. Now at last, and they always throw in Galileo as the person that was challenged in his thinking about the sun being the center of the solar system by the church, because they ask him questions and he faced the Inquisition. We'll talk about that in detail. This is, I say, a simple and enchanting tale, easily followed, utterly captivating in its explanatory tidiness. Its sole defect happens to be that it's false in every identifiable detail. So that's the presentation you get. The Dark Ages were there, the Age of Faith, witches, the Inquisition, the Crusades. We'll talk through all of that. And we'll try to present a little better perspective. Rome and the New Rome. So here's the old Rome. And if you looked out from this position at the city in the year 800, you would have seen cattle and sheep grazing, and this being farmland. I've seen pictures from this time that have sheep walking around the Colosseum, because this was largely abandoned, an empty hulk of a city. And this is the new Rome. This is Constantinople today it's Turkey. Today there are minarets that come up at all around the Church of the Hagia Sophia, the Church of Holy Wisdom. Church is still there, but Islam took over that city in 1453. See, so we've got 1,000 years that this church remains the bastion of Christianity and scholarship, preservation of the classical texts. So we'll look at that story. We left the early 500s by seeing that the major councils had figured out how to explain Christianity. This is one of the best diagrams that I can give you of the Trinity. It's good to be able to describe Trinity without using the word three. Here's how you do that. Here's the seven statements represented here. The Father is God. The Son is God. The Spirit is God. Three statements, three more. The Father is not the Son. The Son is not the Spirit. The Spirit is not the Father. Statement number seven, God is one. That is Trinity. That's a good diagram, a good explanation of Trinity. It's not three and one. It is Father, Son, and Spirit. Also in that late early period, they figure out how to understand the person of Christ. Very difficult. Took a lot of debate to understand that it was two natures in one person, the God-man. Now we go to Ireland. Here's Glendalough. Glen is valley, duh, two. Loch is lake, the valley of two lakes. St. Kevin went there in about 7 years to live in a cave and to contemplate the faith. Western civilization, we said, was saved both by the Irish and by the Greeks. Greeks in the east from Constantinople, the Irish in the west. We'll talk about how that worked. When Christianity swept across Ireland, the Irish fell in love with the Latin language. And so they would take little houses like this and spend their life copying Latin texts. They went to Rome, come back with an armload of Cicero and Livy, and would copy those texts and preserve them. So when Cahill says they preserved Western civilization, it's because they copied and preserved for us many of the texts of the Latin West out of Rome. This is a beehive hut. The Irish are really good at building stuff out of stones because that's about all they've got there. They memorized and copied scripture, a life of meditation. We will think about in the monastic discussion now, how is this an implication of the New Testament? To contemplate God and to spend your life doing that. The Irish were shorter than me. The Vikings hadn't gotten there yet. And so this is the Glarus Oratory. It's a little church, 1,400 years, no roof leaks. That's pretty good. Ours don't even last 30 years. Small window in the east. Remember, all churches are built with the altar or the front of the church being to the east because of their belief in the resurrection. And so that's how that was used. This is the Book of Kells. This is the Gospels, the four Gospels. This was found out in a field, rescued, because this is one of the treasures of Western civilization. Absolutely fabulous book of art. It's the four Gospels, produced in about the 700s. It was probably a Viking attack. They didn't want the book, so they just threw it out in the field. Luckily, somebody rescued it. But look at the fabulous detail that the monks had in producing the text of this beautiful Latin Irish script. The blue is lapis lazuli. It comes from Afghanistan. And so how does the blue of Afghanistan get all the way to Ireland in the year 700? I don't think it was quite as dark an age as we imagine. If you get to Trinity College in Dublin, you've got to stop in and see the Book of Kells. Here is the monastery of Clonmacnoise on the River Shannon in Ireland today. Ireland, I say, is a good place to study the culture of Christianity from this time because the Irish had no money to build parking lots, so they just left everything like it was. These structures have been there for 15 years. You can see that it's a cemetery. Everybody wants to be buried near these monasteries. We'll talk about that idea. Here's Clonmacnoise in the year 800. As it would have been a Christian community. All these buildings, most of these buildings still exist. Praying on the prayers. So the Vikings learned how to build boats in the 700s, and they were big enough that they could get out on the ocean. And so they took off. This is how easy it would have been to take all the gold and silver from this monastery. Their boat was such a shallow draft, they'd come right off the ocean, right up the river, park right there, take all the gold and silver, capture a few monks, and take them back to Norway. we'll talk about the Viking invasions. We're going to move now to discuss this idea of monasticism and the idea of contemplating the spiritual world. In the Vatican is a picture of the history of Western thought. In the center of the picture is a picture of Plato, whose hand is doing this, pointing up, and Aristotle, whose hand is doing this, pointing down. I think that little snapshot in the center of that painting is a good way to explain the first 1,000 years of church history and the second 1,000 years of church history. In the first 1,000 years, the idea of contemplation, the awareness of the spiritual world, as Plato said, the spirit world is much more real than the physical world. The Gnosticism heresy that we talked about 2 weeks ago is all about the spiritual world. Plato and Platonic thought was the dominant philosophy of those first years, and that went into the church. We see that in Paul in the New Testament. There's a lot. He says we don't wrestle with flesh and blood, right? We wrestle with the powers that are in the spiritual world. And so you see the elements of Christianity that push us toward the contemplation of the spirit world. The afterlife was much more important than this life. How does that compare to today? Do we spend much time? Do most of our friends around the water cooler talk about the afterlife? No. They're talking about the Tennessee game or even worse, politics. See, I put politics below football. So here's a couple of concepts that came out of those early days. The Greeks, Aristotle, no less than Plato, as well as the great medieval thinkers, the period we're in, held that not only physical sense perception, but equally man's spiritual and intellectual knowledge included an element of pure receptive contemplation, listening to the essence of things. Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas, said it's necessary for the perfection of human society there should be men who devote their lives to contemplation. If God has no material substance, how can we imagine him except with our mind's eye? We'll talk about that. This is the Hebrew word kadosh. We sang the word, the three words in our preparation for communion, holy, holy, holy. This is the word holy. The word holy in Hebrew means other. So let's think about that as it relates to this idea of monasticism. Kadosh, the root meaning other, which means different, separate from everything else. God is other because he is not contained by the creation. He is not the sun. He is not the moon, as the Assyrians said. He is not a giant oak tree, as the Norse people believed. When Boniface was a missionary to the people of northern Germany, not true Germany. There was no Germany, of course, till the 1800s. But in that part of the world, they worshipped a giant oak tree, the oak tree of Thor. And Boniface said, here's how I can demonstrate to you that this is not real. He chopped the tree down, and they all stood around waiting for him to be struck down by lightning. When that did not happen, many of them converted. There's a plan of evangelism. They don't teach it. An axe. God exists apart from evil, even though evil exists in creation that he spoke into being. That is why the Big Ten, the Ten Commandments, includes a prohibition against worshiping God as part of the created order. He is spirit, and as Christ said, must be worshiped in spirit and truth. What does this mean in our worship? How do we see him if he's invisible? How is the image of God, the Imago Dei, to be understood if it's entirely non-physical? We know the hymn, immortal, invisible, God only wise, in light, inaccessible, hid from our eyes. Paul says in 1 Timothy, God is invisible. So in the old world, that is these 10,000 years as opposed to the last 200 years, all events of life were directly related in the minds of people to the physical world. Storms, crop failure, death of livestock, family members, sickness, all those things were more of a spiritual issue than a physical issue. Right? Modern medicine doesn't come around till the middle 1800s. Paul would have had no job before then, so he arrived at the right time in history to get some income. How different we think today after principles of physics, chemistry, and biology are known. And how should we think about this theologically? Again, like Russell Crowe, that slide, we have to put ourselves in the mind before science and before we understood how the physical world was put together. So we start with St. Anthony. We can call him St. Anthony. You can call Brendan St. Brendan if you want to, right? He's a holy person. He's a holy person not on his own merit, but because of the merit of Christ. So St. Paul can be Paul, but we don't put too much weight on that, you know, in the old days, all right? Because we understand how we got there. So here's St. Anthony. See how early this is, 270. He is the first monk. It's a Christian who raised in Egypt, entered a church. Christian monasticism was born with him. And so this is how we got there. After giving away all of his possessions, Anthony went to live alone in the desert. This is in Egypt. Although he returned to the old world several times in his life, he continued to live in solitude for the rest of his life. In the desert, he prayed and supported his existence with manual labor. He soon became famous for his holiness, and men came to live near him and imitate his solitary existence. I think one of the big driving forces is the statement in yellow. Martyrdom went away when Constantine made Christianity legal in the empire. And so the martyrs were the early saints that everybody honored and followed and wanted to be near. And that's why they tended to hang on to their fingers and arms and feet and anything that they could keep that was left over from them. Now that martyrdom was no longer possible, many men saw the example of Anthony as a new way of demonstrating devotion to God. This expression of the faith now explodes with followers. Athanasius, who fought for the deed of Christ, wrote the life of St. Anthony, which really made him more visible. You used in a memo this week. Hesychism means to withdraw. It is very big in the Eastern Church. You know the phrase, Kyrie eleison, those seven syllables, which means Lord, have mercy. They withdraw. Their idea in the East is to withdraw and to pray this prayer multiple times. And so this is especially a big movement at the time that the Russian church is formed. And so hesychism, this idea of learning to be quiet, learning to meditate and pray this prayer over and over, is a big part of their worship. Let's think of the theological purpose of contemplation. This is key to understanding the monastic world that existed at that time. The beatific vision, that is, Beatitudes, you know, the blessed vision, was the objective, to see God with your mind's eye. We can't see God, right? Like John 1:8 says, no one has seen God at any time but the one and only Son, who himself is God. His closest relationship with the Father has made him known. This vision refers to the transfiguration event in the Gospels, Christ on Mount Tabor. This picture, we think of that, comparable to Moses. Remember when Moses came down from the mountain, his face was so shining that people couldn't look on him. He had to put a veil over his face. Like LED lights in his cheeks. What does this tell us about this scene? The Trinity was shining through the physical body of Christ. This is a major piece of monastery life, especially in Eastern Church, reflected in the icons of that period. It's far distant from our thinking in the West and Protestant theology, but we must try to recapture the culture of the time to understand it. Christian art. So this leads us to the discussion of Christian art. Iconoclasm means to destroy the images. So the images start, we start seeing pictures of Christ all over in the early part of the church, in the early Middle Ages. The East liked pictures, the West liked statues, but we see those multiply. When Islam shows up, I think the key is here, when the Christian emperor Leo III decided to promote the destruction of art, thinking of the command saying don't have images, Islam was winning the wars, and in his thinking, maybe it's because we've allowed these pictures of Christ that we're losing these wars, and Islam is taking over sections of Christian territory. So he said, let's destroy all the images. This is what happened. People would go in and attack the pieces of art at the time, all through the, especially the eastern part of the church, and would destroy it. Let's jump ahead. This is the Reformation. Look around this room, and you see no images. We have a couple of pieces of geometry, right? No physical images, because in the Reformation, we accepted that in our anti-Catholic thinking that statues, images are wrong, and so we have bare walls. The question is, did we throw the baby out with the bathwater in that thinking? So here is the city of Antwerp and the town of Antwerp in 1566. This is the time of John Calvin, announced, as a community, we're going to go through town and we're going to destroy all the statues and we're going to destroy all the images that the Catholic Church has put up as part of our clean up the town mentality. I asked the question, what's the difference between a hymn whose words and sounds lead to worship or a piece of Christian art that does the same? Are the senses involved in worship? We eat and we touch the communion table. The senses are involved. And so that's a question for us. I'll leave that for later. So separation from the world, a disciplined life of studying Christ. Why did they interpret the force of the New Testament this way? Here's the Christian church in the year 900. Looks very different than today. These are all monasteries and convents. They cover the continent. And so how should we learn from our brothers and sisters from this period? The Benedictine rule, Benedict from the beginning of our period, Monastery of Monte Cassino in central Italy created the rules to regulate monastic life, undertook the Benedictine rule. Monks and nuns took three vows: obedience to the abbot, poverty. The monk owned nothing, not the shoes on his feet, not his cloak, not his pen, not his knife. He owned nothing. They took it all away. And then he'd also have this vow to remain unmarried. That doesn't work, right? Because the Catholic Church is in trouble this week as we speak because of the problem with sexual problems. The Eastern Church did not have this rule. In the Eastern Church, priests and pastors were married. In the West, growing out of this idea, and I think it's really a Gnostic idea, that the body is bad, therefore we need to keep a pure spirit, therefore we need to have our priest remain unmarried. It's an unworkable solution. It's unnatural. They still try to hang on to that. Monastic life, the Benedictine rule. Imagine a life which you never got more than 3 hours of sleep at a time. You attend worship 7 times a day, including midnight, 3 a.m., and 6 a.m. They attended worship 49 times a week. You attend worship about 49 times a year. Each day was divided into periods of worship, work, and study. Because they developed better agricultural methods, the improved agricultural economy of Middle Ages. They also brewed beer That's just a little comment to help you. We throw that in. Those who drank beer were healthier than those who drank water. As you know, cholera is a waterborne problem. And they finally solved the cholera problem in London by closing the public wells. So who lived in the monastery and what problems came from this in their approach to Christian life? Those who dedicated themselves to life of worship and study. They lived isolated. The early monasteries were all out in the country, as far from the towns as they could get. They wanted to be isolated, but they couldn't stay isolated because as people had sick kids, they would go seek out the holiest person they knew, and they would go find the monk and say, "Help me, pray for me, my child is sick." Paul didn't exist yet. Those who were given, also people would give their children to the monastery, both as an act of worship, "I'm giving you my child, I dedicate it to God," or, "I can't feed my child, I'm giving you to the monastery." Those who were retirement age, it was a retirement place. And so you needed a safe place where you could be fed and housed. And so old people went to the monastery to live out their dying days. Wealth came not to the individual monks, as we said. They were not allowed to own anything. But people constantly were giving land and money to the monasteries, again, because they thought about the afterlife. If you don't have kids, take my land. I just want to get to heaven. At one point, England, one-fourth of England, belonged to the church because people had just given away huge sections of the country to the church. Reforms were attempted. When you have that much money, it's hard to maintain the discipline, right? And so humans are humans, and so they keep going through reforms because situation became lax, and you'd start sleeping through worship, especially the 3 a.m. one. You know, they'd miss that one. And so things got worse. Now, in the 1200s, a big change happens with St. Francis of Assisi. He says, "Why are we out in the country? We need to be where the people are." So he moves the monasteries into the cities so they can work with the people. And so you have this big change. They moved to urban centers. They took a vow of poverty, begged for food, preached, educated, heard confessions, and cared for the people, acting more like priests than monks. And they only kept enough money for the immediate needs and refused to save or to worry about the future. After a century, they too fell into temptation. You hand out a light penance for money. Here's what they wore. No time to deal with that. The church in the medieval period. During the Middle Ages, the church's most important achievement was to Christianize Europe. It took about 500 years for them to get. By the year 1000, Christianity had reached Denmark and Norway, and they were starting to build churches in the Viking lands, the last section to be Christianized. 597, Pope Gregory sent Augustine to reconvert. When the Romans withdrew from England, Christianity withdrew, so they had to re-Christianize England by sending missionaries back in. From Britain, later missionaries were sent back to the continent. Ireland was a huge source of mission work and scholarship. In Charlemagne's court in the year 800, he needed scholars because they were copying scripture and teaching. They were opening public education to the peoples to learn Latin. They went to Ireland to get the scholars as teachers. By the late Middle Ages, Europe had become a Christian civilization, having pushed Islam back from the edges. I'm going to spend a lot of time next week dealing with the invasion of Islam and how that happened, and discussing Islam as a challenge to Christianity. Women also spread the faith. Some women married pagan kings and brought husbands into the church. This is Queen Clotilda, who brought, through her husband, the Franks to Christianity and big change there for the next 1,000 years. The role of the parish priest, Christian rituals and faith, part of the fabric of the everyday life. In villages, there were no cities at the time. Paris was about the size of Woodbury, London not much bigger. Or local religion, region was often only the only contact people had with the church. People couldn't read, people couldn't write, so it's the parish priests that taught them the Bible stories. As we saw, the Irish high crosses were little images, little cartoon images of Bible stories that the priest would use to teach. Images were critical to that because your people can't read, so you're giving them pictures to teach them Bible stories. That next week, 2 weeks, I'm going to show you a picture from a cathedral in Milan, which every major Bible story in the Bible is a separate pane of glass. It's about 10 stories high and about 100 feet wide. It's an enormous stained glass window that teaches all the stories of the Bible in one place. The priest celebrated Mass. Oh, he was also the only person that could read and write. So if you got a letter from your cousin, you went down to Brandon to say, could you read this for me? I can't read. So the pastor, the priest, became a very important person in town. Priest celebrated Mass. We'll talk about what the Mass is later. Administered the sacraments, which totaled 7. Ex opere operato, which means by doing it, the work is performed. In other words, Christians believe that participation in the sacraments would lead them to salvation and heaven. Europe slowly being converted to Christianity. Missionaries came from Ireland and Italy. Eastern Europe and Scandinavia remained the pagan, remained polytheistic until the 11th century. You notice we're at the end of our hour and I'm not at Beowulf. So we're going to have to do Beowulf next week. I'll end with a story of Willebrod. My grandmother's name was Fries because she was a Frisian. They're right on the edge of the North Sea in northern Germany. This is Saxon community. Willebrod worked in the Frisian tribes. Today would be the Netherlands in the 8th century. He convinced the king of the Frisians to become a Christian and to be baptized. Baptism of the bath carried heavy weight. It's the mark of being a Christian as it does in non-Christian cultures today. As he stepped into the fountain of baptism, he asked Willebrod if he would see his forefathers in heaven. He explained no, his relatives would be in hell and not in heaven because they didn't know Christ. And so the king stepped out of the water and refused, saying that he'd rather die a pagan to see his family in hell rather than be separated them forever. The Frisians were not Christianized for another 100 years until they were conquered in battle by Charlemagne's forces. I think that's why he's got kind of a sad look on his face, because he had a lot of trouble communicating. It's interesting if you read the early translations of the Gospels that they use in northern, among the Germanic tribes in the northern Europe. Everything is put in kind of the power and conquering and the sword. I read the section where Peter, you know, cuts off the ear of Malchus in the Garden of Gethsemane, and that sounds like the mighty chieftain Peter rose with his sword. But his superior chieftain said no. And it's all presented in this very warlike kind of culture to communicate the gospel to these people. So we're going to have to leave it there. Next week we'll dive into Beowulf and the Islam challenge. And so that'll be a lot of fun. So don't miss that. So let me pray for us and we'll end. Father, thank you for your grace in preserving the truth through our brothers and sisters from these earlier periods of time.